As the flooding due to Hurricane Matthew continues in the Carolinas and the cleanup and rebuilding begins in other parts of the southeastern United States, we are going to talk with a guest who says we need a cure for catastrophe. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will talk with our guest risk management expert who says disasters are determined by where we build, how we prepare, and how we warn people, and that we need a disaster policy and a culture change to solve the way we deal with natural disasters. We will welcome your thoughts and your questions and wonder if you think there is, as his book title suggests, a cure for catastrophe. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Robert Muir Wood, the Chief Research Officer of Risk Management Solutions and a visiting professor at the University College London's Institute for Risk and Disaster Reduction. He is the founding editor of the magazine Terra Nova and has published 6 books. His latest book is The Cure for Catastrophe: How We Can Stop Manufacturing Natural Disasters. He joins us from London. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, let's talk about Hurricane Matthew hitting the southeastern United States. There's a lot of storm damage and flooding and a death toll of at least 36 over the past week in the southeastern United States. As the storm moved closer to the U.S., President Obama advised residents of the coastline to take the hurricane seriously. Florida Governor Rick Scott told residents to evacuate using strong language, including the line, "This storm will kill you." How do you rate the response, or at least the warnings for Hurricane Matthew?
The warnings, I think, in the states impacted in Florida, in Georgia, and South Carolina were good ones. This Hurricane Matthew was not nearly as bad as it could have been. It took a very fortunate track, just actually running offshore along the east coast of Florida, and by the time it did actually make landfall in South Carolina, it was actually a lot weaker than it had been. So this was a near miss, in fact, and it's been more than a decade now since there was a really intense hurricane hitting anywhere along the U.S. coastline, and actually people probably are not as well prepared as they should be, simply because they haven't had any real experience of a big hurricane since the famous hurricanes of 2005, Katrina, Rita, and Wilma.
Still, though, with those very dire warnings, this storm will kill you, there were still people that, you know, stayed put, and they're going to ride it out. And now there was this near miss, and it wasn't as bad in at least parts of that region as we thought it might be. Is that going to make people try to sit the next one out too?
Well, yes. The danger is that we have what we call the story of crying wolf, which is it's a very, very ancient story, goes back more than 2,000 years, to the story of the boy who is sent to guard the sheep and who gets bored and starts shouting out wolf every now and again to scare the villagers, and the villagers come and see what's going on, and eventually when a wolf does come, they ignore him. It is a danger that if we have what we call a false alarm evacuation, and people see nothing happen, that the next time they get an evacuation, some proportion of them won't evacuate. So we have to be very careful in actually in overstating the threat in certain situations. Now, I don't really think that's happened on this occasion, but it is a danger.
Yeah, I mean, Hurricane Matthew, at least, I mean, it killed hundreds of people in Haiti, and it was a monster. It looked like, and it even looked for a time that it was going to turn around and hit Florida a second time. I mean, that was a scary situation.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is worth contrasting the situation in In the U.S. and with Haiti. Now, this storm was much more intense when it hit Haiti, in fact. But here you have a country which is in a desperately bad state around its preparation for disasters. It is. I mean, in the U.S., well, in Florida, you only really have one big peril to worry about, which is hurricane. But in Haiti, they really have three. They have earthquake. They have hurricane and they have really intense floods as well. And they have a very weak government. So the government is actually not in position to tell people, to advise them about how to build or where to build. People, as you saw in the pictures after Matthew, people have been building right on the beachfront in a section of the coast which has the potential to be hit by really big hurricane storm surges, so very high sea levels, big waves, and very, very strong winds. Extremely dangerous location, and hundreds of people died as a result. And we have this problem that there was in Haiti a great earthquake with hundreds of thousands dying in 2010, and so the focus has been on let's protect people against earthquake, but actually sometimes the buildings which do best in earthquake may do worst in a hurricane wind event. So it's very tricky to actually give people the right advice to plan to protect themselves against all the perils to which they may be subject.
Yeah, and I think in this case and in many cases with hurricanes, at least from my my vantage point as a media person, it seems as though the winds, while certainly can be dangerous, it's that storm surge or that flooding that that causes the most damage or maybe the even more deaths.
Absolutely, yeah. It is the most dangerous element is the storm surge, and actually where that gets concentrated and how big it gets, and it's quite tricky because the storm surge is driven by how intense the storm is, how big the storm is, so how broad it is very important for defining how big the storm surge rises, and also by whether the coastline is shallow or not. If you have a shallow coastline, the storm surge gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And so, for example, in Hurricane Katrina along the coast of the state of Mississippi, the storm surge reached something like 25 feet high because, in part, the water was so shallow offshore, in part because the hurricane had been very, very intense and very, very big offshore. And a lot of people died who stayed in their houses in that hurricane along the coast of Mississippi, who even those houses had survived a hurricane which occurred in 1969 called Camille, which was at maximum intensity, Category 5, we call it. But Katrina was even bigger than Camille, and a lot of people who stayed behind in their houses lost their lives as a result of believing that it couldn't be any worse. So storm surge is absolutely the most critical, most dangerous component of the hurricane's armory, and people really do need to listen carefully to the warnings when an intense hurricane is hitting is aimed for a section of coastline. Again, we haven't seen. I mean, we saw in Superstorm Sandy, we saw a quite an exceptional storm surge for the region, for New Jersey and New York, but actually we haven't seen an event like Katrina, for example, all the way back to 2005, and people probably, they may be in danger of forgetting what the power of such events can be.
Yeah. Well, we have just a minute or so before we need to take a news break, but did we learn lessons from Katrina that we're using today when say Hurricane Matthew comes along?
Yes, I mean, one lesson we learned from Katrina was that there used to be a very simple scale that was used to giving people warnings about these storm surges accompanying hurricane. I mean, you will probably know this five-level scale that is used for determining the intensity of a hurricane, Category 1 up to Category 5. And And it was thought that you could simply link the intensity of the storm to how high the storm surge was expected to be. And it took Katrina for people to realize that system simply did not work, and actually that was the way in which people had decided to stay in their homes, because Katrina was only Category 3, and yet Katrina had a bigger storm surge than Camille, which was Category 5. So they've now abolished the scale which was in use at the time and come up with a new one, which simply gives an indication to people of how big the storm surge is going to be, independent of actually what the intensity of the hurricane is. And so that was an important piece of learning, which actually should save a lot of lives going forward.
We are talking with Robert Muir Wood, who is the author of The Cure for Catastrophe, How We Can Stop Manufacturing Natural Disasters. And we'll ask him when we get back from our news break exactly what he means about manufacturing natural disasters. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with the author of The Cure for Catastrophe, How We Can Stop Manufacturing Natural Disasters. And we're welcoming your thoughts and questions for him. He says that the scope of a disaster, a natural disaster, is determined by a number of factors, like where we build, how we prepare, and how we warn people. And he is advocating for a disaster policy and a culture change to solve the way we deal with natural disasters. We wonder if you agree or not, if you have any questions, or maybe you have some experiences to share. Have you ever been in a natural disaster? Certainly, Wisconsin has its share of natural disasters, not hurricanes or tsunamis, but we have tornadoes, we have flooding, a lot of flooding that occurred this past summer in the Driftless region. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Robert Muir Wood, Chief Research Officer of Risk Management Solutions and a visiting professor at University College London's Institute for Risk and Disaster Reduction. I wanted to ask you to explain the subtitle of Robert Muir Wood, How We Can Stop Manufacturing Natural Disasters. How do we manufacture natural disasters?
Okay, well, I mean, once upon a time, any disaster that happened seemed to be some kind of surprise, in that you were on the coast somewhere, you were hit by a hurricane, you were in a town or in a village somewhere, and an earthquake hit. And once upon a time, we could simply claim that actually natural disasters were, we used to call them acts of God, that they were a surprise. But we now know a lot about the science of disasters, which tells us where they can occur. It tells us where we can expect big earthquakes, where hurricanes are likely to hit, which areas can be flooded, and and with that knowledge, it means we have the power to take action to very significantly reduce their consequences, to prepare people for them, to make sure the buildings can withstand them. And so, when bad things happen in disasters now, then those bad things are almost always the consequence of the fact that we haven't taken on the fact that disaster was going to happen sooner or later. We haven't built properly, we haven't prepared properly, we haven't evacuated people properly. And so, the idea that these things are simply natural, it doesn't really work anymore. The disasters we have, the very large majority of them at least, we have in a way manufactured them. I mean, manufactured may sound kind of strong word, but we have, by our actions, by by not doing things, by not considering what is likely to happen, by not preparing for them, by allowing construction to go on in dangerous zones which are going to be hit by tsunamis or by floods, for example, we do manufacture disasters. And once we recognize that actually we are in the business of manufacturing disasters, that also that gives us some hope that we can do something about it, because if it's our actions which have created the problem, it's also another set of actions we can take to actually very significantly reduce the consequences and get to the point where, you know, we could have a big hurricane somewhere and actually no buildings are damaged, nobody loses their life. How do you have a big earthquake somewhere and the buildings take some small amount of damage but actually can be restored quite quickly? That is not an impossible goal. I mean, that is something we could aspire to. Now, we're not there yet, but actually, once you get the idea that we are manufacturing the bad things, we also have the means to start thinking about what is the solution.
Yeah, well, as the people start to clean up and rebuild from Hurricane Matthew, would you say that they should not necessarily rebuild on a barrier island, which must be very beautiful, but can get hit by a hurricane every so often?
Well, I mean, I think it's hard to prevent people completely doing things, but if they do it, they should completely understand the situation. They should understand the risk. They should understand what has the potential to happen. And actually, I mean, the key thing is they shouldn't expect other people to subsidize their decision to build there. And at present, there is quite a lot of ways in which the people who are at highest risk for flood from hurricane along the coast are still typically enjoying some subsidy that people inland or everyone else, all the other taxpayers, are effectively subsidizing them for their decision. You should definitely not subsidize people to do dangerous things, so that would be a start. I mean, it's actually very hard to say you shouldn't do this at all. But actually, I think if people have, you know, they know the financial consequences, they know the chance that actually they're going to lose their beachfront house, that might help them maybe take a different decision.
And what do you mean by subsidizing? If I have flood insurance, am I being subsidized, or is that not being subsidized?
If you have flood insurance, well, the way the
or hurricane federal, insurance or whatever.
Well, the way the federal flood insurance system works is that after it was introduced, all those properties which existed before it was introduced back, I think in the 70s, all those properties were allowed what is called grandfathering rights, whereby they were allowed to maintain quite low levels of the cost of their flood insurance in perpetuity, in effect. And there was an attempt a few years ago to change that, to make people pay the full cost of the true cost of the risk, the true cost of the flood risk, and actually on the basis that then the people who are at highest risk would have to pay the highest premiums. And actually it was so unpopular it was thrown out. So currently, if you have an older property on the beachfront, in effect you are enjoying a very low insurance cost, and the people who are further inland or anybody who's a federal taxpayer ultimately is actually subsidizing that person to live at a location which is high risk.
Yeah. So besides that consideration, what else? What do we need for this cure for catastrophe? What do we need in a new disaster policy?
Well, we need a mixture of education and information, I would say. I mean, we need communities to recognize what their risks are. So a key first step in this is, and we have the science to be able to do this now, but a key first step is actually to get individuals and communities to acknowledge this is the risk of earthquake, this is the risk of flooding at this location. And that first step is a very important one. And then you need to create what I call a disaster culture, a resilience culture, a culture of people who recognize this is a collective problem. This in a way, everybody shares this problem, and we need to find solutions together to for example, to get people to back building codes. I mean, building codes are very efficient ways of actually ensuring that new construction is built to a standard, so it doesn't suffer life-threatening damage in strong shaking, in an earthquake, or in high hurricane wind speeds. So building codes are a very good step for actually minimizing what is going to happen when this particular hazard, this hurricane or earthquake hits. And there are more things we can do to actually get communities to take ownership of ensuring that we are taking the actions which are going to reduce the consequences, making sure we're listening to the warnings, organizing evacuations when necessary, doing all the best behavior which we can see works from around the world, from different countries who are pursuing the same agenda. By this means, we have the power to get to the point where you have a big, as I say, a big earthquake or big hurricane, and you don't need to have a lot of bad consequences as long as you have prepared effectively.
Yeah, and we're not doing this already. We don't have building codes that would make a building withstand an earthquake or a hurricane.
We are doing some of it, and we're almost certainly not doing enough of it. I mean, it's quite hard. I mean, for example, in the state of Florida, after Hurricane Andrew in 1992, it devastated a region of Miami-Dade County, and actually, and after that, there was a new, much tougher building code was introduced. But in fact, it was only in those counties which were badly impacted that the building industry agreed to this new, much tougher building code. And for the rest of Florida, they argued it wasn't, it wasn't worth doing. It's going to be too expensive, and so the building code is not as good for the rest of Florida as it is right in the southeast corner. So there are forces out there which can argue against taking the action which is going to be most effective at reducing the consequences. And we find, as you say, building codes can be effective, but actually, in many countries in the world, I mean, less so in the U.S., there may be a building code, but actually, people don't use it. They simply get someone to, they get a building inspector, they pay them a bit of money to sign off that the building is okay, the building is not properly strengthened, and that is the building which is going to fall down when the earthquake hits. So in many other countries, we have a lot of problems of enforcement, and basically that's because the culture of the people has not signed up to agree that actually reducing the consequences of disasters needs to be a priority.
Well, here in Wisconsin, which you probably are not too familiar with, we had some really stormy weather over the summer, super heavy rains, like 8 inches an hour or something ridiculous like that. It left behind widespread flooding and all sorts of damage. There's an area of Wisconsin called the Driftless Region that does get hit. The Kickapoo River will overflow and flood from time to time. And in fact, it's resulted in at least 2 communities moving their town to higher ground. But these are still supposed to be like once, 500-year or 100-year floods, but they're happening more and more and more. So a couple of different questions here. What should communities like this do to prepare for the future?
Okay. Well, I mean, I know Wisconsin a little bit. I've visited a couple of times. I've got good friends.
I didn't know
Marlene
that.
And Dale, who live in the northern part of the state. But yeah, you're right. In Wisconsin, your principal perils are going to be flood and also occasionally tornado is probably a problem too. And the flood situation, I mean, you're describing communities which have clearly engaged with understanding the information we have about the flood hazard. So the first thing is to get, as I say, is to get educated about what is the picture of hazard in this location and understand how often we can expect floods to happen. You're right, there may be some situations where certain classes of flooding may be becoming more frequent. And then get communities, I think community is a very good level to help organize things, to make decisions, to get communities to actually decide what to do. I mean, should you raise buildings? Should you make sure all the new construction is a few feet off the ground level? Should you prevent construction in certain areas because it's too dangerous, it's going to get flooded too often? What is the best course of action? I mean, it's not possible. It is best to map that course of action at a community level, to get a community to understand with a specialist what their options are, how they can minimize the impact to the benefit of everyone. I mean, we know that flooding is a really bad experience to go through. It can mean 6 months before people can move back in their buildings again. They lose all their family mementos in the flood. I mean, it's a dreadful thing to go through, and anything we can do to ensure that communities don't need to go through it is going to be a good thing.
Yeah, and I guess before we take another news break, I did want to talk a little bit about what's supposed to be, you know, that once in a lifetime flood, or that once, you know, the 100-year flood happening, you know, two or three times in a decade. Is this climate change, or, you know, how do we prepare for that?
The term of the hundred year flood is a bit of a, I mean, it's a useful way of thinking about these events. But it's somewhat misleading because it gives you the sense that once you've had one of these events, you wait 100 years before it happens again. So the better way of saying it is that it's a flood which has got a 1 in 100 chance of happening in any 1 year, and actually, potentially, if it happens in 1 year, it could happen in the next year too. There's no reason why it shouldn't. Then, as you ask, there's this question about are the probabilities, are the chance of these events occurring, is that shifting, is that changing? In some classes of peril, so I mean, it's not universal. In some classes of peril, there is some evidence that there is some change, where there may be some change in the wildfire season, for example, out west, as to how long that lasts. That is something which we may see changing as a result of a warmer climate. There may be more intense outbreaks of rain causing flooding. That may be changing too. It's still uncertain exactly how fast these changes are going to happen. But we clearly need to be thoughtful about it. But if people are in a flood zone, they might ask the question, what happens if floods become more frequent?
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I spoke over you when you said that you had friends in Wisconsin. What area of the state are you familiar with?
I have been to Madison, but I'm not even sure where the friends I do have exactly where they live. I know they live up north. I don't have their
address. That's a good way to put it, up north. We say that all the time too. So, thank you. We will talk more with Robert Muir Wood after we check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, talking with him about his book, The Cure for Catastrophe: How We Can Stop Manufacturing Natural Disasters. And we're welcoming your questions and maybe even your own experiences. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Talking with him in the wake of Hurricane Matthew, but we are talking not only about hurricanes, but other natural disasters and how we can better our outcomes. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Chuy Kerdine, talking with Robert Muir Wood, who is the author of The Cure for Catastrophe, How We Can Stop Manufacturing Natural Disasters. According to our guest, hurricanes and earthquakes and tornadoes, they're natural, but the outcomes are human. He says the scope of a disaster is determined by where we build, how we prepare, how we warn people. He is advocating for a disaster policy and a culture change to solve the way we deal with natural disasters. And we're welcoming your questions. We're welcoming your own experiences. Are you prepared? Do you think you are prepared for a natural disaster like a flood or a tornado? Or maybe you're a snowbird and you live in Florida. Are you prepared for a hurricane? Do you think your community is prepared? Do you think our government is well prepared? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Chuy Kerdine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Chuy Kerdine Show. Well, David in Lancaster emailed. He said, if we are serious about disaster response, we must also be serious about addressing the multi-million dollar funding that denies the consequences of human-driven climate change. I guess David thinks that, you know, we need to accept that climate change is playing a role in perhaps the frequency or the scope of our natural disasters, some of them, and how are we going to have a culture change if we don't even accept that climate change is influencing this?
Okay. Well, the I would say the starting point is to understand the risks, the hazards, the hurricanes, the floods, which we have been having anyway. So I mean, we should first of all focus. That's what I mean on developing a disaster culture, which really comprehends what we can expect anyway. And then there's a question about how is that going to change in a warmer world. And as I mentioned, there are some elements, some hazards where we can already see some signature of change. We know the sea level is rising. That means every time, even if we have the same storm, the height of the storm surge is going to be a bit higher because the sea level has already been rising. We know that that intense rainfall episodes are likely to become more frequent. Wildfire maybe expanding. How many months over the year it's going to affect people? So we know that as the world is likely to get warmer, that actually some other perils, we may see other changes. We may see changes in hurricane activity. I mean, there are theories on that. There are projections. We may see changes in the severe thunderstorms as to where they track. Maybe they'll shift latitude. So we should be open to anticipating that some of these hazards are going to change. But the starting point is to recognize that we are already in a hazardous world. It's not that the hazards didn't exist before, but actually maybe they're going to be worse. They're going to be in different locations.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about actually earthquakes. I know we don't have a high risk of earthquakes in Wisconsin, but you know what? We have some. There is I think it's the New Madrid Fault, which is in the Midwest that we could that way back when did have the walls come tumbling down in Wisconsin as well. But I saw a story recently about all these tremors in Southern California around Palm Springs, and there was a lot of concern that the big one was coming. And the story that I saw also talked about how there are just homes built right on top of the San Andreas Fault. And I thought of you when I saw that story.
Okay,
in that what in the world were we thinking?
Well, I mean, this is a a big topic. So just to recap a little bit, I mean, first of all, your big earthquakes in the Midwest were in 1811 and 1812, so more than 200 years ago. But there were three of them. They were very big and very, very damaging. They highlight the fact that the risk is not entirely on the west coast of the U.S. There is some risk in the interior. We know in Oklahoma that as a result of injecting the wastewater from oil production, they've been generating a lot of earthquakes. The most recent one had a magnitude of about 5.6 and happened about a month ago and caused it was in a rural area, but caused quite a lot of light damage to buildings. And then you have the situation in California where it's been a long time now since the last really significant earthquake back in 1994 in Northridge near LA. And again, people, I think, have become a bit complacent, and there's been no wake-up call. And actually, sooner or later, we know it is inevitable. There is what is called a plate boundary running through California. The San Andreas Fault is a key part of it. We know it is inevitable. Sooner or later, there's going to be a big earthquake on one or other section of the active faults in the region. And we have situations like in Hollywood itself, where the location of all the film studios of Beverly Hills is actually built on top of an active fault. So we absolutely have been busy manufacturing the potential disasters in that region by building in quite dangerous places by in the past not necessarily respecting the building code. The modern buildings are actually built quite well in LA, but there's a lot of legacy buildings which are not so good, which are likely to fall down in a future earthquake. There's now a big initiative in Los Angeles to actually to go back and do what's called retrofitting, which is to go back and actually try and make those most dangerous buildings safe. I think they've identified something like 14,000 buildings which need attention. We need constant vigilance in that situation to identify what is going to be dangerous in a significant episode of ground shaking and actually take action to prevent it killing people as it inevitably will, unless we actually make that building safe before the earthquake happens.
Mary emailed, "No one is ever really prepared for a natural disaster unless they have been through it." What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I think it's a very good point. Unless you have been through the experience of having your property flooded, or having been through a community hunkering down for a hurricane, you don't really know just how big and bad this event can be. It's very hard to get a perspective as to how powerful these forces are, the forces in a hurricane, or the force of a really big earthquake, until you've been through it. I mean, clearly, if you have been through it, then for the rest of your life, you are going to be someone who takes careful consideration about thinking of the hazards around you. I mean, having worked on a number of earthquakes, for example, if I stay anywhere in earthquake country, I check out the hotel I'm going to stay in and make sure I'm pretty confident that it would withstand an earthquake if one was to happen. That's easier somewhere like California, where the, as I say, the modern buildings are good. But if you're staying in Pakistan or Algeria or somewhere, then you are pretty suspicious of the quality of the building of even a hotel where you may have to spend the night.
Yeah. So what gets in the way of us taking action when it comes to disaster?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, there are a lot of forces which actually do get in the way. And I mean, I try in this book, The Cure for Catastrophe, I try and tell a lot of stories to sort of explain what does get in the way, and also stories to explain what works. But I mean, one example I mention is that in the city of Tokyo in the 19th century, they had a big earthquake in the city, and the military governor at the time he wouldn't allow people to write a commentary to criticize the government, but people who drew pictures were allowed to publish these pictures, and these woodcut artists and some of them started making an image where they showed the idea for what caused the earthquake in Japan was that it was a giant catfish. So this is the idea for the Namazu is in folklore in Japan causes the earthquake. And so one of these woodcuts showed the people of the city trying to hit the giant catfish with their spades and their hose, and you know, trying to stop it having earthquakes. But then there was another community of people around the edge of the picture who were the people who were trying to stop the citizens themselves, were trying to trying to hurt the Namazu. So there were people in the city who quite liked having earthquakes, and that's what this woodcut showed. And these people included the blacksmith and the carpenter and the house builder, and so there are. This was a sardonic reflection that in Japan at the time there were people who did quite well out of having earthquakes. It gave them more business, and that is a simplification to see the world like that. But actually, there are forces out there which are not so completely interested in actually in investing money in stopping disasters, and actually we have to recognize what those forces are in order to work out how to get around them.
Well, unfortunately, we won't be able to get into those forces in detail because we're out of time for the hour. Thank you very much for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
Robert Muir Wood is the author of The Cure for Catastrophe, How We Can Stop Manufacturing Natural Disasters. Thanks to Brianne Chasso and to Naeja Ellison for producing this program. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned. The Week in Review is coming up next. And coming up next week at this time, I hope you will join us on location in Wausau. We are going to be broadcasting live from the 6th Street Filling Station, which is a restaurant in Wausau. We will be talking about politics and much more. So join us next week in Wausau as we go on Wisconsin Vote on the Road.